great pleasure for me to be here at MIA because the Carriage House is, in some sense, one of the temples of mathematics exposition, communication in the nation. And this lecture is, in some sense, my attempt to communicate to the general public some of the things that I love about mathematics. The objects I'm going to present are polyhedra. But I want to start by making a little reflection about the human nature of mathematics. Many of you love mathematics, and that's why you are here. And that is, of course, the public that hopefully will enjoy my lecture. But there's many other kinds of people in mathematics, or they have a different relation with mathematics. So we know that there's people that fear mathematics. There's people that are confused about mathematics or that are afraid of mathematics. But the most dangerous kind of people, in my opinion, are the people that think they know mathematics and that they think mathematics has no role in their lives, that the mathematics is useless, perhaps. By the way, all these little statements about mathematics are, I found by doing a simple Google, you know, like everybody, I can do Google and find all kinds of interesting things. So if you Google hate mathematics, you find incredibly interesting statements about mathematics. I mean, really people that hate mathematics enormously. And again, I mean, people that fear mathematics, I mean, they say, oh, you know, I mean, I'm sure some of you that are teachers or professors, when you are sitting on an airplane, the person next to you says, oh, what do you do? And then you say, I'm a math teacher. There's a long silence, and then there is, I was very bad at math. Or I hated math. But I want to specifically address this third kind of people. Those are the most dangerous kind of people. The ones that took a lot of math classes. They think they know what math is about, and they came to the conclusion that math play no role whatsoever in their life and will never play any role whatsoever in their life. I was telling Ivars the story that the reason I decided to prepare this kind of lecture is because I was sitting on an airplane next to a person that had gone to Harvard Law School, I mean, he, very highly educated person. He had taken AP Calculus, AP Statistics, and he said, math is dead. What is your job besides, you know, just repeating what everybody knows? So this person, you know, with a Harvard education did not know that math can actually help you make better decisions in your life, and that math is beautiful and that math is alive. So my intention today is to present several short 15 minutes each snapshots of mathematics alive, mathematics research alive. The first two will be, let's say, a little bit more on the pure side of mathematics, just why math is still alive, but it's more on the pure geometry. And then I will come to the justification of why actually math is very much present in real life. Okay. So one last philosophical remark. I think we really need to take the fight for mathematics very seriously. I mean, MAA does a lot. All the math associations do a lot of this. But I think it's, again, we need to do as much as possible because, to me, this is a national tragedy. We need to change the attitude about mathematics. So I'm going to talk about these beautiful objects called convex polytopes. And I will start with a little bit of introduction of what they are, just very casually. When I'm telling you what a cat is, I should show you lots of pictures of cats. So here they are, some beautiful models of convex polytopes that I have in my office. Here are some more convex polytopes that you see, except the thing that has hair. those are lots of examples of convex polytopes. Some of you may actually be studying that in your class, I understand. So, but, you know, what is the kind of polytope that I want to understand is not this kind of polytope. You see, there's a very fundamental difference from the polytopes that I showed in the previous pictures to these kinds of polytopes.
They both are made out of, kind of out of flat surfaces. You build them out of flat pieces of cardboard. But if you notice here, there are spikes. This is not a convex polytope. The kind of polytope that I want to study is one that doesn't have spikes, that is not like a banana. That is, for example, to be more precise, if you take two points inside the polytope, you connect those two points with a line segment. That the line segments must be entirely contained in the set. So, for example, this is not convex, but this is convex. A circle is convex. An egg is convex. But this object is not convex. Okay? Is that clear? So I want to study these kinds of objects. And as I said, they are made out of flat pieces of cardboard when you see them in three dimensions. In general, you can take a plane. So you take a plane, that plays the role of the piece of cardboard. And when you have a plane, imagine that you are slicing space with a knife. If you have your plane and shoot, you slice it with a knife. And every plane divides the space into two pieces. The same way that here this line divides the plane into the green and the yellow piece. So you have these pieces are called half spaces because essentially you get the space divided in two. You get the space divided in half, right? So my convex polytopes, here comes the mathematical definition. So you see, mathematicians, when we actually talk with each other, we have one very specific characteristic that differentiates us from physicists and from chemists. We like to be extremely precise and picky about how we talk. So here is the picky definition of what is a polytope, which I may not use so much, but just so that you have it. The polytope is nothing else than taking finitely many half spaces, so things that you get by slicing with a knife, and taking all those and intersecting them. And so when you do, imagine that you have a huge piece of cheese, which is a space, entire space, and you take your knife and you slice, cut. So at the end, you're going to get these chunks that are going to be convex polytopes. So that's what they are. And again, if you didn't understand this part, don't worry. It's going to be enough that you stick to the beautiful pictures that are made of these flat things. By the way, of course, my definition allows to do things in many dimensions. So you live in three dimensions most of the time. Of course, there's the time dimension, but you live in three dimensions for visualization purposes. In my talk, I will get into many more dimensions. Okay, so here comes the first problem. I want to talk to you about the problem of the faces. I'm going to talk about anatomy of convex polytopes. So for that, I need to tell you the body parts of the convex polytopes, essentially. And you see, the polytopes are made of these beautiful pieces that you glue together. And you, for example, the cube, you made the cube out of four squares. Well, but we need a way to talk about those pieces. That's the anatomy of the polytope. It's like your nose or your arms. So those are the faces of the polytope. So what is a face? Well, you have your polytope. Oh, by the way, I always carry a polytope with me. You know, never leave home without a polytope, essentially. So I actually brought two polytopes today. One that is a little bit fat and roundish. And where's the other one? Oh, here it is. I have a foldable cube. I always like to use this foldable cube for explaining what a face is. So when you have a polytope, take a plane. The plane is going to be the surface of this table here. And you start slowly lowering your polytope until the polytope just kisses the table, just touches the table gently. Well, at that moment, whatever you touch is a face. So, for example, this line segment is a face. But you say, well, there's another way. I can hold my polytope like this. I start lowering down and boom. This time, I touch in this corner. And that's a face again. Or I can do, you know, I can just lower my polytope like that. And now the face is a square, right? So these are all faces of a polytope. And I'm interested on a very simple mathematical property. How many faces are there? You know, that's as simple as that. So by the way, here again, I'm explaining the blue plane is touching the polytope, just barely. And that is, that's why I say it's kissing the polytope. Just it's very romantic, you know, just kissing slightly the polytope there. Now let's, so this gentleman that is on there is one of the most famous mathematicians in history, the Swiss mathematician Leonhard Euler. He was fascinated by the faces of polytopes. So he was the first who really started thinking about how many faces are there. But he first make a distinction. So let's say when my face is a single point, you know, it's a single point, it's a zero-dimensional face. So that counts as just a single point. There's no dimensions. It's just zero-dimensional. When my face is a line segment, well, that is one dimension. And then finally, when my face is just square, well, that's two dimensions that you need to draw the object. So you can count, so you can construct, let's keep track of the number of faces, but let's keep track of the number of faces by dimension. So I need your help so that you see, to see that whether you understand. Can you tell me how many faces of each dimension are there for the three-dimensional cube?
Well,
let's practice. How many zero-dimensional faces?
Eight.
Thank you. Eight. How many one-dimensional faces?
Four.
Thank you, yes. And how many two-dimensional faces?
Six.
Very good. Okay, so that's a set of three numbers that I'm going to call the F vector, or the face vector. So this is going to be the face vector. This is the face, you know, F is an abbreviation for face, so S is the F vector of the cube, of the three-dimensional cube. Now let's suppose, where is the cover, sorry. So let's suppose now that I think there's a group of people here that are fans of the Platonic solids. Yes?
Yes.
So let's see, I'm gonna give you a little chance to tell me what are the F vectors for the tetrahedron. So let's see, I'm gonna put the tetrahedron, the octahedron, the dodecahedron. These are the famous, of course, this is the famous Platonic solids, which I'm representing here in a funny way, I'll explain in a moment. And of course, the icosahedron, the favorite polytope of IMAA. Okay, tetrahedron, what's the F vector there? So how many zero-dimensional faces?
Four.
Six.
Four.
Four. Exactly. So why don't you start thinking about the other numbers here? So while you think about the other numbers, let me just make a comment that you see I'm drawing the Platonic solids in a very special way. See, what I'm doing is, you see, it's very hard when I have it like this in my hand. Don't you agree that it's kind of hard to count the faces because you go one, two, you lose kind of track, right? Because counting in three dimensions is kind of hard. So I like to flatten, you see, what I'm doing is I'm literally flattening my cube. That's why I like this cube a lot. So I flatten it into the board. It's easier to count the faces, don't you agree? Yeah? Okay, so are you ready now? What are the other ones?
Six.
Uh-huh.
12.
Eight. It's actually the opposite direction of the cube, right? Mm-hmm. And the dodecahedron?
Three.
Sorry? Yes. How many vertices?
Yes, 12.
20, right? Uh-huh.
12.
And the icosahedron is going to have the reverse one, like that. So is everybody in agreement with this? Yes? Okay.
Now, look at this amazing thing. So in mathematics, there are also general laws, like in physics, there are general laws of relativity and gravity. Well, look at these numbers. If I take the number of zero-dimensional faces minus the number of one-dimensional faces plus the number of two-dimensional faces, now I want everybody to look at this calculation for this. Pick any of them. Pick any of them. Okay? Pick any of them. Yeah? Whichever you want. Pick one of them. Now do this calculation in your head. Are you ready? Mm-hmm. Now, when I say three, you say the number that you get. One, two, three.
Two.
You see? It's always the same number. This is the famous equation of Euler. This is the famous formula of Euler. So he discovered this beautiful relationship. And in fact, so he generalized it. He didn't prove that, but he knew already that if you go to d dimensions, now you have a polytope like in four or five dimensions, and you can still count, I mean, this is a free country, in more dimensions it's even more free, right? You can count zero dimensional, one dimensional, two dimensional, three dimensional, four dimensional, etc., all the way to d minus one dimensions. And sure, there's going to be a similar equation like this every single time. So it's kind of fascinating. And then Euler, he was a fantastic mathematician, asked the following question back in the 1700s. He said, can we characterize somehow what are the possible F vectors of three-dimensional polytopes, like the cube or like this guy here? I don't know the name of this guy, but you know, many of these have the names. They're Archimedean solids. And so the question is, if I give you, for example, suppose I come and I say 11, 11, 17. Is this the F vector of a three-dimensional polytope? No, why? How do you know? Because it doesn't satisfy the equation, right? So it's like a law that it needs to satisfy the Euler's equation. But if I now change it, you see, now I say this is 20. It does satisfy, it's equal to 2. Is there a polytope? So here's the question. Is there a polytope that has 11 zero-dimensional faces, 20 edges, and 10 and 11 facets? And the answer is, we know the answer. This gentleman, a German mathematician in 1906, his name is... Steinitz, he figured it out. He said, guess what? If you know that your vector satisfies the Euler equation, I mean, that's of course is necessary, but you also satisfy, your number satisfy these inequalities, then there must exist a convex three-dimensional polytope that has that F vector. Okay? That is what he discovered. That's amazing, isn't it? So let's try to make sense a little bit about why some of these vectors, some of these inequalities, because you may have seen the Euler formula, but I don't know if you have seen these kinds of inequalities. So when you have a polytope, let's go back to my pictures that are flat. I'm going to try to make sense of this inequality. 2 times the number of edges has to be at least three times the number of vertices. I already used this fancy word. Vertex is the name that people use for zero-dimensional faces, and edge is the name that people use for one-dimensional faces. All right. So, but let's go back. When you have a polytope, look at every one of the vertices of the platonic solids. Let's look at the platonic solids. They are very good examples of polytopes. What do you notice? When you look at a particular vertex, how many edges surround it? At least three, you see? So that's why you know that you always will have the number of vertices times 3, yes? When you multiply that number, you must be counting edges. But how many times did you count the edges?
Twice,
because every edge belongs to two vertices, right? So that means that this must be this must be a lower bound on 2 times the number of edges. And voila.
You see, you get a very natural bound for why these are the necessary things. So Steinitz said, if you have a vector of three numbers, of three integer numbers, that satisfies the Euler equation, satisfies these two inequalities, it must be the F vector of a convex polytope. Okay? And that was a wonderful achievement in 1906. And now you may be saying, well, that's it, but that will happen in 1906. How much advancements have we made since 1906? Well, back in 1906, Steinitz asked the natural question, what's the similar theorem, what's the similar result in mathematics for four dimensions? So in four dimensions, a polytope is going to have zero-dimensional faces, one-dimensional faces, two-dimensional faces, and three-dimensional faces. Okay? So the question is, can somebody come up with some like Euler equation and this inequality that, you know, she comes up with those equations, and whenever I give her a vector with four numbers, she can say, yes, this is the vector of a convex polytope in dimension four. Well, guess what? Nobody knows the answer to this. Even today, you know, more than 100, you know, it's 106 years ago. So in fact, I have a friend, it's a mathematician, who works on this problem, and he was really hoping that by 2006, we will solve that problem. He was really trying hard. I know that for sure. He was really trying with his students and collaborators to get the complete list of four-dimensional equations, the equations in four variables that completely classify this vector. But he didn't do it. Now, nobody knows still. You see, that's my first example of how mathematics is still alive and growing. Yeah? Is clear? Is the question clear? Yes? Is the open question clear? So you can explain it to anybody. You see, in four dimensions, we don't know what are the possible combinations of number of faces on a polytope. Yeah, it's very easy to understand.
There's an Euler equation?
Yes, there's an Euler equation also for four dimensions. And it's going to be F0 minus F1 plus F2 minus F3. So it's an alternating sum like that equals 2. And then there's minus 1 to the dimension. So it's going to depend on the dimension. Yeah. So that's true. But there might be more inequalities. And maybe there's a quadratic equation, right? Maybe there's a cubic equation. Is the problem clear? Okay. If you didn't understand anything, don't worry. Wake up. Imagine that the talk just started again, okay? Yeah? So fresh, okay? If you just came in, don't worry. I mean, it's fresh. Let's start. I want to start with a different problem now. So, you see, I'm telling you, my talk is made of four short lectures. So, Wake up again. Nice. Hi, my name is Jesus. Okay, so I want to tell you. So, you know, I just talk about four dimensions, five dimensions. And you might be thinking, well, if I want to see in four dimensions, five dimensions, I probably need to go get some drugs, you know? But I want to show you how mathematicians visualize higher dimensions without any illegal drugs. So here's how you do it. First, I'm going to explain to you how I got these nice pictures of the platonic solids. What I did to get these nice pictures of the platonic solids is I imagine that I have a light that is very, very close to one of the faces, one of the two-dimensional faces. And then that light shines and casts a shadow below. So, for example, here I'm demonstrating this with this beautiful picture. The light is there. And you see there's a triangular prism that is, you'd get a flat version of it. Okay? This is a very nice way to represent polytopes in dimension higher to go from, you know, dimension D to D minus 1. So this is a way that I went from a three-dimensional polytope to a two-dimensional picture. You see? Now, I can do the same in higher dimensions, no? But I want to talk to you today about my favorite way to visualize polytopes in higher dimension. And this is something that goes back to my childhood. When I was a child, I loved to go to the paper store because there they sell something they sell polyhedra but in paper. So I don't see that they sell those here in the US, by the way. Maybe they do, but anyway. So here's how it goes. You have your polyto, and you take some scissors. You know, I take some scissors and I start chuck, 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 cutting, 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 and then I open the polyhedron flat on a piece of paper. So if I take my dodecahedron here, and I cut, 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 and I'm careful, I mean, I have to be careful, I get things like this. Everybody see that? So all you're doing is cutting, cutting, cutting along the one-dimensional faces in such a way that when you open, like imagine that these are hinges, and then you open the doors, and then you flatten it on the surface, right? I mean, it gets flat like that. By the way, you see immediately that there's many different ways to do it, right? In this example, I mean, I'm choosing this. So let's see whether you understand. What is that? It's a cube. It's a flattening of the cube. By the way, some people call these nets. They call this a net of a cube. And this is a fantastic way to visualize. Actually, it's my favorite way because I can send, via email, I can send a polyto, right? I can create these things. I have a software. I can, if you stick around at the end of my lecture, I can show you software to do these things. So you can flatten these polytopes. It's awesome. So, and then you print a PDF file. Well, you get a PDF file, you send it to your friends, and or, for instance, you give it to your students like that. And okay, so now here is the four-dimensional cube. This is a flattening. This is a net for the four-dimensional cube. Yes. So that makes kind of sense because you know this is the one-dimensional cube. This is the two-dimensional cube. This is the three-dimensional cube. You see? If you look at the progression, you know, if you look at the progression, the faces of the cubes are cubes. Right? The faces of the cubes are cubes. So you should expect that the faces of the four-dimensional cube should be three-dimensional cubes. You see? So that's what I get. By the way, does anybody recognize this picture? Has anybody seen this picture before? Anybody likes art? For example, that Salvador Dalí, there's a famous rendition of the Christ crucifixion with a four-dimensional cube. It's one of the... Okay, open question. You can get your PhD tomorrow if you answer this question. It's so simple. I mean, you can explain it to a... You know, I go to elementary school classes and I explain this problem and they immediately try. And this is what I like about kids that are young. They're not afraid to try. They still don't have this, oh, I'm bad at math, and you know, or I hate math. They just try. They, you know, they just find it curious and they try. We should be like children. So here's a question. Can one always find, no matter what polytope I give you, a way to cut, 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 cut along the edges, and then you flatten it out? But remember, I want to send this via email so that my friend in the other side gets the email, prints that into his printer, and then can build back the polytope, right? So if I send my friend something like this that is overlapping, is that going to be good? No, because I cannot, you know, I cannot build this back. I cannot get a polytope back because it's overlapping, right? So the question is, can I always print? For instance, this is a tetrahedron that is kind of longish tetrahedron, and I did something stupid, and I flatten it, and I get this kind of bad representation. And you see, you understand the question, right? It's clear. Is the question clear? Can you, no matter what polyhedron I give you, find a way to cut, 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 and flatten it on the table without self-overlappings, right? Without self-intersections. Well, I don't know the answer, and as far as I know, nobody knows the answer. And by the way, this is so simple to explain to anybody. And it has so many interesting applications. For example, how do you send a telescope to space when this telescope is huge? Well, you know what they're doing in NASA now? They're folding it. So they have, you know, they assemble the telescope, and then they make it in such a way that you can fold it. And the question is, how do you unfold it when you get to space? You need to do some mechanism. It's a mechanical design. You want to design things that are huge and round or in any kind of shape, but you can fold and unfold as you please to transport the object, right? So it has really a lot of applications. There's fascinating questions about this, how to do it in practice. That was my second open problem of the day. I love this one in particular because I think really you can explain it to very young students. Are there any questions about this? Yes?
Is there anything known about the, you know, are there limits? Can you tell us something about the answer? What is known about the answer?
Well, I can tell you that the contract, if there's going to be something that is not going to be open, let's say, that you cannot create a net for it, it needs now to have, they know that it needs to have at least 20 zero-dimensional faces. So it needs to be a, kind of a large object. But it's, remember, this is a question in three dimensions, right? We should be, if somebody, you know, a smart person finds an answer for this, we should all be able to see the picture. So it would be a picture that you can see. Here it is. No matter how you cut, you will not be able to unfold.
It needs to have how many vertices?
At least 20. That's what they know.
They're so small.
Well, yes, but you see, already the number of possible polytopes with 20 vertices is huge. So it's quite an achievement to argue that you cannot do it. It has to, the counterexample, as we call it in mathematics, has to be larger than 20 vertices. Yes?
This reminds me of the time I bought a shelf. Which was folded and flat, and it was supposed to be put underneath the kitchen sink, and I couldn't unfold it. I only have a PhD in math, but I brought it back, and the directions were so unclear that I couldn't even do that simple operation.
Right.
You don't have to go to NASA.
Yeah, well, for example, there's books about these things. I highly recommend the book by there's a guy in MIT. Yes. That he, so they and also there's somebody else, Joe Mitchell, at Stony Brook. They wrote several. They have written several books about this topic.
What was the first prominent author?
Deline, but don't ask me to spell it.
Yeah.
D-E-L-I-G-N-E.
Right. Okay. So now I'm going to switch gears. So the last two problems I'm going to talk about, if you did, again, wake up. If you just arrived, like a year, don't worry, you are fresh. You can start. My name is Jesus. Nice to meet you. So, you see, polytopes, so far I have talked to you about just very, you know, oh, how beautiful they are. But this, I mean, the second problem was kind of applied. You know, it's a practical question. But you can say, well, you know, who's going to care, really? You know, NASA or... But I claim that polytopes are extremely useful. I mean, literally, I would not be here. I mean, I'm not kidding. I would not be here without polytopes. I'm not kidding. I got this quote on the internet. I Google, math is useless. And I got this quote. So there's a student that says, I think when people say math is pointless, they're talking about things like systems of linear inequality, or that most people will never use in their life. I literally ask my eighth grade teacher, my eighth grade math teacher, when we are going to use this, and she said, you are. You know, when I saw this quote, I was boiling in anger. I was literally boiling in anger because I mean, whoever that teacher is, I just felt she just offended me personally. Yeah, I'm not kidding, because you know what polytopes are? They are solutions to system of linear inequalities. That's what they are. So a polytope, if you represent it in algebra, so every geometric representation has an algebraic representation. So here is the example. So when I have a half space, you know, when I have a line, Remember that I define polytopes to be intersection of half spaces. So I draw a line, that's my plane, and I divide the space into two pieces. Well, this equation is a linear equation. So this is, you know, ax plus by equals d. You know, that's a linear equation. And if you say that it's above or below, what does that mean? That has to be less than or equal or greater than or equal, right? That's all saying below or above. So a polytope, the beautiful objects we have been studying for the last half an hour, or actually 35 minutes perhaps, is is the set of solutions of a system of linear inequalities. And this math, and this eighth grade teacher had the nerve to say, you aren't going to use them. You know, that's not going to be useful. Well, I want to prove that eighth grade teacher wrong. Okay. Well, one of the most interesting applications of polytopes is actually something called linear programming. Linear programming is, mathematically speaking, is if you have a polytope, you have the set of solutions of a system of linear inequalities. Remember, if you don't understand what this is, it's just this object, but in algebra. So it's the, this, that's the, this, this set of inequalities, the solutions of that is this object. Well, so you have, and now you have another plane. You have this plane, and you're swiping the plane and trying to find what is the highest point when you swipe the plane in a particular direction. So, you know, if I swipe the plane, at the very end, I hit the highest point, let's say. And that is what linear programming is all about, is to find the highest value, or the smallest value, doesn't matter, of, you know, what a plane can have as you move on a polytope. That's what linear programming is all about. Now, you may be saying, well, what is that good for? Well, it's very good, it's very useful, actually. I mean, here is the simplest example of a linear programming problem that I can think of. Sorry if there's people that are not in drinking age. I apologize for the example. But suppose you have this factory that produces two kinds of beer. You have a factory. You are the manager of a company, okay? Very simple problem. You're the manager of a company that produces two kinds of beer. Now, beer is made of three ingredients. Beer is made of corn, hops, and malt. And to make an ale, you need 8 pounds of corn, 4 ounces of hops, and 16 pounds of malt. And if you want to make the other kind of beer, you need a different quantity, yeah? Because it's a different kind of beer. But your company only has 320 pounds of corn, 130 ounces of hops, and you know this is the amount of malt that you have. Okay? So you have a limited amount of resources. Now you're the company manager. You want to make money, right? Money, money, money. So you want to make the largest profit possible, but you know that a barrel of ale, you sell it for $16, and a barrel of beer, of the normal beer, you sell it for $12. So the question is very natural. How many barrels of ale and how many barrels of normal beer should you make to make profit? Well, let's think about it. Well, you know that, let's call XA is going to be the number of barrels of ale, yeah? Of ale. And then XB is the number of barrels of normal beer. And that, so what is that you want to maximize? Well, you want to maximize the profit. Well, the profit is, I claim, is what? Can anybody help me? 16 XA plus 12 XB, right? Right? That's clear. That's the profit. Because for every barrel that I make this much money and this much money. Now, how about the restrictions on the amount of material that I have? Well, clearly you have, because you have restrictions on the corn. How about the corn? Well, you have XA, the ale needs how much corn? 8 ounces of corn or 8 pounds of corn. And how much do you need for the other beer? That's also 8, right? 8 XB. The amount that you use cannot be more than what? It cannot be more than 320, right? So you get the idea, right? Let's do one more, maybe. What the heck? So the number of, for instance, the malt. So the first can of beer needs 16 pounds of malt. But the other kind needs 32 pounds of malt. And that you only have how many pounds? You have like that. So you see, it's a system, it's a polytope. In fact, it's a polygon. It's a two-dimensional problem. So you can draw it in the plane. But you see,
This is a very natural question. I mean, I think this appears in many situations. You have a finite amount of resources, and you want to find a solution for that. Well, that's a polyto. You're finding the best point on a beautiful object like this. I mean, 3 dimensions, 4 dimensions, 5 dimensions, depends on what are the variables that you are considering. No?
Okay, so I hope you believe that polytos are useful. Here's another one that is one of my favorites. It's a little bit more sophisticated. So you have a company that makes laptops. In laptops, for example, maybe in 4 factories, one is in DC, another one is in Philadelphia, I don't know, Pittsburgh, someplace in the East Coast, what else? New York. And then in the East Coast, in the West Coast, we need laptops, you know? So Sacramento, San Francisco, San Diego, we need laptops. So, you know, that's how many people need laptops, we need this many laptops in Sacramento, but DC only produces 108 laptops, right? And now there's a prize to send a laptop from DC to Sacramento, or from Pittsburgh to Sacramento, yeah? There's a different prize. So you want to make the assignment of which laptop is going to come from where, trying to minimize the cost. This is a very natural question. This is another linear programming problem. It's another polyto that you want to find the biggest point, the highest point on that. Okay, now I'm going to teach you in 5 minutes what I teach my undergraduates in 10 weeks. So get ready. So there's something called, so one of the most extraordinary methods to solve this problem is called the simplex method. This was invented in the Second World War by George Danzig. George Danzig is seen here. He died, 5 years ago, probably? He invented this because he was working for the Air Force. And, you know, the Air Force had a major logistic operation during the war. So how do you make decisions that make sense? Well, you use polytopes. Yeah, use polytopes. So Danzig said, how do I find the optimal solution of a linear program? I will explain to you how he does it in geometric terms. So he said, first of all, observe that an optimal solution has to be on a vertex. It has to be a zero-dimensional face. There has to be an optimal solution in one of the vertices, one of the corners, okay? So then Danzig said, okay, let's start at any vertex. Let's just say I start here. If that is not the highest point, then I can find another vertex that I can walk and I improve. And if that is not the highest point, I can find another point and I improve and I move and I move and I move and I move. So you see, you are walking around on the polytope. You see, you are walking around on the polytope from one vertex to the other. So you're literally doing this red path on the surface of the polytope. Is it clear? So that, my friends, is the famous simplex method. 2 years ago, it was voted as the most important, one of the top 10 most important algorithms in the history of mathematics. It's used every time you fly an airplane. You bet. The crew members were assigned to that airplane thanks to this method. Pretty much anything that requires decisions of large scale, you know, like routing airplanes or, you know, where to drill on oil fields, you bet they use the simplex method. It's an extraordinarily important algorithm in mathematics. Nevertheless, and this is the amazing thing, we use it all the time. Humans, companies pay $15,000 for software to solve the simplex method, but we don't know how it works completely. There's a lot of open questions, mathematical questions about how it works. So what we want to know is what is the diameter of this graph. So let me explain to you that very quickly. So you have your polytope. I'm walking on the graph. So that means I'm walking from the vertices, the zero-dimensional faces, along the edges, which are the one-dimensional faces. And I want to know what is the shortest distance, that will be the distance between two vertices. For example, these two guys are at distance what? Distance 3, because the length of the shortest path is 3, I claim. Uh-huh. See? 1, 2, 3. I need 3 steps to go from here to there. How many do I need to go from there to there? Let's see. Where. Two. Just 2 steps I do it, right? So that's the distance between 2 of these vertices. But the diameter is the largest possible distance. Okay? Now, guess what? Nobody knows how big this number can be. And for years, people have been looking at what is the best bound? What is the best bound on the distance, on the diameter of this graph? Because that will tell you the performance of the simplex method, which I told you is very used every day. So this I'm showing here, I mean, I'm running out of time, so I don't want to spend too much time on this, but these are the best bound the best bounds that we know today about the diameter. So if you notice, the diameter is given here in terms of the number of facets, the number of faces of higher dimension, and the dimension. And nobody knows what is the answer. For almost 50 years, people believed that this was just going to be the number of facets minus the dimension. That was going to be the biggest diameter possible. And then, in 2010, a Spanish mathematician showed that this is false in 43 dimensions. So he had to think in 43 dimensions to find a counterexample. It was an amazing feast. You see, today, we still don't know the answer. Can somebody find what is the best bound possible on the diameter of a polytope? Okay? Given the number of facets and given the dimension. Okay? That is the question. Nobody knows the answer to this. You know, not only you will probably get your PhD tomorrow if you solve this, but you'll get tenure immediately too. So I want to get to the last problem. Okay. So I started at 5 after the hour. I have 12 minutes, is that okay? Okay. So I want to come to the last application of the night, the last open question of the night. I hope you have enjoyed so far. But again, wake up if you didn't understand anything. Let's take a deep breath, start again, you know, fresh. You know that my attention span is very short, so I want to start again. Suppose you didn't. Okay. So now I have polytopes and I want to count points that are inside the polytope that have integer coordinates. Yes? So for example, here's a pentagon and I'm counting the red dots, the ones that have integer coordinates, you know, 0, 0, 2,7, etc. No? Those are points that have integer coordinates. So you will say, why would you like to do that? Well, guess what? I'm sure everybody here knows Sudoku, right? So you may say, well, what are all the possible Sudoku configurations? Well, guess what? They are the lattice points on a polytope of certain high dimension, right? I guess dimension 81, I guess. So these or also magic squares. If you like magic squares here, you know, there's a magic square. So how many different magic squares are there? Magic sum 5 that are 11 by 11. That nobody knows how to calculate that. But you see, that's a mathematical computational challenge. How would you count the number of lattice points on a polytope of high dimension? And I'm telling you, even for this example, the 11 by 11 magic squares, counting those problems is beyond human capability today. So we have formulas for 10 by 10 magic squares, but not for 11 by 11 magic squares. But this is Washington, D.C., and I want to convince you, so my ending will be, has to do with a very, we're in the season of election here, and we're in Washington, D.C., so I decided to end my lecture with convincing you that counting integer solutions on polytopes, counting the points that have integer coordinates on polytopes, is extraordinarily important for elections. Yes, it is, I'm not kidding. Okay. Some of the people in the audience are too young to know who these people are, I guess. So this is, yes, and some of the people we wish we could forget, yes. But so let's just say that a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there were three candidates. There were three candidates that I'm going to just call A, B, and C. See, this is A, and that's B, and this is C. And I did not order them in the kind of politics that they like. But I want to just make a point that different countries have different election systems. Yes? For example, in Mexico, where I was born, to be elected as president is enough to have majority. So if you got everybody got, let's say, 5% of the vote, but you got 6% of the votes, you are the president. Yeah, that is enough to have a simple majority. You are the president. That's it. In France, if you people here follow the French elections, there's so-called runoff election, where if nobody gets more than 50% of the vote, then there's a second round of elections. With the top two candidates, they get again. So, but there's a sad fact of life, my friends. Different electoral systems get different results on election day. So here's a very natural question. Suppose that I change the electoral system. What is the probability that the winner for the simple plurality voting, which is the Mexican system, will be different from the French system? Is the question clear? So I have the same kind of voters, but I just count the votes differently by the different electoral systems. And the question is, what's the probability that I actually end up with a different winner? Okay? I'm going to answer this question using polytopes, of course. So what am I going to do? I'm going to write for you in the last 7 minutes that I have left. I'm going to write for you a system of equations, inequalities, a linear system of inequalities, the ones that describe polytopes, whose integer solutions are going to count the different electoral votes. Are you ready? So let's do it, okay? So I'm going to use some variables. I need to introduce some variables. So what are going to be the variables? So let's do... Yeah, so there's three candidates. There's A, candidate A, candidate B, candidate C. And I'm going to... So every person in this room has a set... Well, right now in the American election, there's only two candidates, but, you know, everybody in back then...
Some of us are
wishing
for a third.
Yeah?
Some of us are wishing for a third.
Exactly. Some people were wishing there was a third candidate. In fact, there is a third candidate. I misspoke. You know, there's a green candidate in this election. Yeah.
You can always vote for an independent.
Sorry?
You can still vote for an independent.
Yeah, there you are. So, but I mean, so
like
every the point that I want to make is that every person, given three candidates, you know, if I tell you three names, you know, I don't know, Obama, Nader, and Bush, you're going to, in your mind, given your political beliefs or whatever, you're going to order them in certain order. So there's a certain number, NABC. So that NABC is the number of people in the United States that believe that A is better than B, better than C. Yeah. So remember, NABC is the number of voters that believe... You know, A is better than B, better than C. See, I mean, and you get the idea, right? N, C, A, B. Yeah, it's the same thing. Number of voters that believe that A, C is better than A, better than B. So there's six categories of voters. Only six possibilities. Of course, you may be saying, well, come on. Some of them don't make sense. Why would you prefer a very left-wing guy, then a very right-wing guy, and then a center guy? I mean, maybe that doesn't make sense, but mathematically speaking, those are disjoint possibilities, right? So maybe there are some people like that. I don't know. Now, the point is that in the United States, let's call M the total number of voters in the United States or in a country, no? So we know that M has to be equal to NABC plus NACB, all the six possibilities, right? This is the sum of these variables. Now, I'm going to use these variables to write inequalities. Okay, I'm going to write a system of inequalities that these variables need to satisfy. What's the first condition that these variables need to satisfy? Are there negative number of voters?
No.
So there are zero voters or positive voters. Right? So the first condition is that all these variables have to be non-negative, which is a non-linear condition. It's a linear inequality, by the way. Look, it's a linear inequality. Now, I just told you that the sum of all the possible voters has to be equal to the total number of voters, right? Okay, So now I'm going to make a little assumption, and I will explain this assumption. So without loss of generality, I'm going to say that A was the winner of the plurality vote of the Mexican-style election, but B was the winner of the French election. Yeah. So I'm going to assume that. So that means that the Mexican, in the A, has the most votes, but he does not have 50 more than 50% of the votes. This is what this equation says, that the people that prefer A over B is not more than 50% of the vote. That's why you have to go to the runoff election. Is it clear? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what does this equation say? This equation says that the number of people that prefer A was in the first round of election was bigger than the number of people that prefer B. See, that's in the Mexican election, A would have won the election, right? Now, but you told me also that in the French-style election, B was the winner, which means that the number of people that prefer, exactly, these three variables tell you the people that prefer B over A at some way. For example, these people here, you know, the second choice was C, but C is out. So they prefer B, then C, then A. So that's essentially they prefer B before A. Okay. So this is the system of equations. But you want, of course, the number of voters. Can you say the number of voters is 35.7? That doesn't make sense, right? It has to be 37 or 35. It's an integer number. There's not half people voting. Well, so we hope, at least. So, okay, so what's the probability of this happening? Well, I claim it has to be multiplied by 6 because I made the assumption that A wins before B. But it can be that A wins before C or B wins before C. So there's 6 possibilities that I have to consider. So these 6 times, the number of solutions of the system, integer solutions of the system of linear inequalities that I just showed you, right? Which is the number of lattice points on the polytope. Okay? And now I have to divide that by the number of all possible voting solutions, which is the set of all vectors of non-negative integers that add up to the total number of electorates. Okay? So you use my software, I wrote some software, and then you count the number of solutions, the number of lattice points inside the polytope. And then you divide by that number, and then you assume that M is very large. You can let M go to infinity if you want, because the population of the United States, for example, is quite large. And then you get that the probability that the two voting systems are going to give you different candidates is 12. We were asked a challenge by a political scientist. Can you figure out what happens with 4 candidates? Because there are some countries, believe it or not, that have more than 2 parties. And more than 3 parties. Mexico, for example, has more than 3 parties. And yes, so we figured out exactly, we managed to figure out the probability for the two different systems getting different answers for 4 voters, but not for 5 voters. Sorry, for 5 candidates. So if you have a system with 5 candidates, it's a challenge. We don't know how, we cannot compute it. We know the mathematics, we know the calculations we need to do, but we cannot compute them because it's too difficult for a computer to figure out. So we need smart young people to do that, okay? Okay, let me conclude. I'm actually going to end on time, believe it or not. So polytopes, my beautiful polytopes here, are wonderful ambassadors of mathematics. They're beautiful and simple, and everybody likes them. Little kids love them. You can even use them as soccer balls. So they are good ambassadors for mathematics. But not only that, they help you make good decisions. I just show you how they can be used to decide about what kind of beer you're going to brew. They can also help you decide your candidate, your electoral system, maybe. So math is useful and beautiful. Math is alive and growing. So there's plenty of math that we need to still discover, and we need more people doing mathematics. And you don't need to be a genius, trust me, I know that. So, I really appreciate MAA's efforts on doing the outreach to the public. We need to do more. If you like math, please talk to your friends that hate math and convince them, you know, that math is awesome. Thank you so for your time.